Why do I conduct my show on this manner? Mundo!
Sweet mother of God, what is the holdup?
Eleanor!
Once again, something wonderful in my life has been turned into a giant crap fest.
Mundo!
Got a little bit more cock for you here.
Eleanor!
Bow tie boy got the big snaggeroonie.
Mundo!
Oh, six of my nipples are tingling.
Eleanor!
See why America loves him so much?
Mundo!
I'd like to smash you in the face with my shillelagh.
Eleanor!
I have no idea what's going on.
Mundo!
He was lying.
He said he never tells a lie.
He was lying when he said that.
Eleanor!
I want a cup.
Well, could you spell that?
C-U-P. I want to see you. Oh, my God.
I know nothing. Nothing.
Stomach batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
For God's sake, strap yourselves down.
Yeah, baby, that's right. It's the show your bosses don't want you to listen to. The show that's going to tell you the truth about what's going on in the workplace. So wake the hell up. It's the Cup of Joe radio show. I am your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio, the voice of the working man, the voice of the radical middle, and the voice of those who have been unvoiced by the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration and its corporate allies. Our engineer, Sock Puppet Sam, is here.
Hey, Joe, what do you know?
And we got a lot of stuff to talk about, but before we do that, Sam, give us the URL for the site.
That's cupojoe.blogspot.com.
And the email address.
J-O-E-V-E-C. At
okay, once again, I want to welcome all of my fans listening in at the White Rose Society. My thanks to my good friend Ben Birch for hosting my archives there. Also, my listeners at RantsRadio.com, RadioPower.org, and CadronPictures.com. And I do have some news about the Cam Mafia thing. I have been in more contact with them, and it looks like, hopefully, maybe, this coming Saturday, which would be the, what is today? What is today? It's June 17th, so about the 20th or so, whatever. 20th or 19th on Saturday from 4 to 6 p.m. on Cam Mafia Radio, and I'll give you that URL a little later on for that. But this is going to be an all-music show. It's going to be called Audio Hell, which is a name I stole from my friend Dave Merrill. I'm sorry. He does an anime hell thing. And this is called Audio Hell, and I'm going to be having stuff that he's going to send me, and he'll be on the show whenever he can, as much as that's possible from Canada when he moves. But it's going to be all the music stuff that I've been wanting to do that I really can't do because, you know, Rant Radio and Radio Power, they're really not music stations. And I love doing the music, and I love doing that sort of stuff. So it has been a very interesting week. A lot of things going on. I was not on Air America Radio this weekend, and I hope to be on this coming weekend. And what happened was, because of the Reagan death, they said that they were going to be talking about Washington after Reagan, but I think they were talking about the coverage of Reagan after in Washington. And they said they were going to only have a DC only talk show host, but they wound up having one woman from New Hampshire who, as it turned out, was a return guest. And they talked about anything but the Reagan thing because they talked. So I'm not really sure what the deal is there. If I'm on this weekend, that'll be great. I'm not holding my breath for it at this point because I really don't know what the hell is going on. I'm not privy to their meetings. It's quite possible that they just simply looked at this show and they said, you know, this guy's really not our caliber. And he only gets a few hits a day on his website and only gets a few hundred people listening to a show. So he's really not worth the time. A couple of people from the chat room. In the Bart Cop chat room, called up. And by the way, I've been talking with emailing Bart Cop a couple of times, and I'm trying to get him to be interviewed here on my show, and hopefully we can work something out. I love doing interviews. Interviews take up a lot more time and make it a lot easier for me. You know, it's not easy sitting here rambling on for 20 minutes or so at a time, as you really need to do. When I do an hour show, I really try to do three 20-minute segments, and I really try hard to do two shows a week, and it's very, very difficult for me because, as I said, I do work for a living. But several things have happened in the last week, a couple of weeks or so, that have changed for me. The first one and big one being getting a car, as I mentioned last show. That will save me about an hour and a half time in the afternoon before I go to work because I used to have to leave to get to work at 3:30. I used to have to leave at about quarter after one. And, now I don't have to leave quite so early. And what happened is I actually got a new job. I don't mean a new job from a different company, but a new job within the plant that I'm working on. They had what they call a job bid where somebody could transfer to a different area. And I signed up for what they called Assembly B, which is basically small parts assembly. I put screws in, or I'll put a piece of metal down in the right way, something like that, or I'll stick a label on somewhere. It's nowhere near as physical a job. In fact, it's nowhere near as difficult a job as what I was doing. And I'm actually making a little bit more money now. I'm making about $12.50 an hour, not because I switched over so much, but because it was my 6 months time and I got a 25-cent an hour raise, which is about an extra, after tax, about an extra $6, $7, $8 a week. But I'm very happy for that. Any little bit helps, and especially since I now owe the IRS a few bucks, I'm going to have to deal with them as well. So we'll take these things as they come. I like my new job. I like where I'm working. It's a lot better. A lot less physical, like I said, and I don't come home physically drained anymore. Here it is. As I sit, it's 1:11 a.m. on Thursday. Thursday morning, the 17th. See, I can't remember the date already. June 17th, Thursday morning. And I hope to get this show done in time to get it on Rant Radio on Thursday. Because that's really how I try to make my schedule go. Rant Radio has it Sundays and Thursdays. Sunday very late, Thursday fairly late, because they deal mostly with Pacific time. My show in Eastern time appears 12 midnight on Sunday, or Monday, however you want to put it, and it's at 9 p.m. Eastern on Thursday. And I fix it so that they might actually start playing some of my archive shows. It will be archived there, but it won't be like readily available. They'll just play it randomly. Mostly Rant Radio has Sean Kennedy, which I think is the only one that they have been backlogging for now. But maybe hopefully they'll put some of the more Cup of Joe shows out there and more people can listen to it. Radio Power, I have no fucking clue when they put my show on. I have absolutely no clue when they put my show on. I've talked to the lady in charge of that, and she's a very nice lady. Basically I'm not in a scheduled slot. I basically fill in some time when they don't have any regular shows on. I am proud to be a part of the same network as like Randy Rhodes and Tom Hartman and people like that. Air America, again, as I mentioned, I'm really not sure what the deal is with them. You know, I don't know if I have what it takes to be a big-time, massive radio talk show host. If I become that famous, there are skeletons in my closet. I'm sure that if anybody wanted to dig deep enough, they could find. And as I said in the last show, I am not the most moral man in the world. I have done some pretty bad things in my life. Nothing I've ever gone to jail for. But some stuff that I'm just really kind of ashamed of. And I want to admit that here. Because most talk show hosts will try to get you to think that, you know, they're somehow more moral. You know, Dr. Laura is the worst of that. She'll sit there and try to say she's more moral than you and you ought to make moral decisions. Well, you know, all I ask from people, all I ask for myself is to try the best you can. When I was younger, I did some really, really stupid things, some really, really bad things, things I should never have done, and things that if I had to do over again, I would avoid like the plague. But unfortunately, when you're younger, sometimes you're not thinking straight. And, you know, it wasn't a situation like with Henry Hyde, where he was like 60 years old, and they found out he had had an affair, you know, 20 years ago, and he was in his 40s. And he would call it youthful indiscretion. No, that's not a youthful fucking indiscretion. What I did was some youthful indiscretions, and I'm very ashamed of them. I'm not going to bring them up in detail, but let's just say that I am not the most moral person in the world, and I'm not asking any of my listeners to be the most moral people in the world. All I ask is what I ask of anybody. Be good to yourselves, you know. Don't be selfish, but think about yourself and try to improve yourself and your lot in life. Treat other people with dignity and respect. And just in general, be nice to people. Treat them as you would have them treat you. That's really all I care about. And again, I'm not trying to get people to, you know, be the most moral person. You know, we're not Jesus Christ. We're not the most moral people in the world. We do the best we can with the gifts we're given. And that's really all I want to say about that. Okay, I posted this on the Cup of Joe blog, and that's cupojoe.blogspot.com. And again, email me, joevec@bellsouth.net. I'd like to hear from you. I've gotten some very good emails lately. A guy named John in Pittsburgh sent me some email, and he's having a really rough time right now. But he was telling me about Pittsburgh's public transportation system. And I can't believe how expensive they're also $1.75 here at Martyrs at $1.75. But at Pittsburgh, they charge you 50 cents for a transfer. That's unbelievable. I never heard of anybody charging for a transfer before. But I guess, you know, all public transportation is in the hole. He wrote me and told me about a time when it shut down for a couple of weeks, and it was really miserable. You know, a lot of people look past the fact that, never mind a lot of people use a bus system to go to work, but there's a lot of people who simply can't drive. Older people, younger people, people who don't have a license, or people who simply don't fucking want to drive. And they have to use the bus system. And, you know, if it's not an efficient public transportation system, then it really can hurt people. But anyway, I digress on that because that's not really what I wanted to talk about. Recently, my wife and my roommate and I went to see The Life of Brian, Monty Python's religious epic, which is actually, it was a funnier movie than I remembered it being. When I saw it, I was laughing a little bit more than I had, than I can recall when I had seen it the times before. I mean, it's not their funniest movie. Holy Grail is still their best movie by far. But it's a pretty decent movie, and there's a lot of good things in it. And the thing that really cracked me up was the little fights between the different political factions in there. Now, for those of you who haven't seen The Life of Brian, let me place it for you. It takes place in Judea around the time of Christ. There's a guy named Brian who was born at around the same time. In fact, the opening of the movie, the three wise men wind up in the wrong stable. And the mother is the Virgin Mandy, as they call, played by Terry Jones, who's like, you know, and the wise men are trying to explain, you know, that they think this Brian is the Messiah. And they're like, you know, we were led by a star, you know, and she said, led by a bottle, more like, you know, people wandering around in a cow shed at 3 o'clock in the morning. It didn't sound. So anyway, he was born around the same time. And they do actually show Christ twice in the movie. One, when they find the right stable, and there's Joseph and Mary in all their holy glory, and, you know, in the baby. And then once, very briefly, when he's doing the Sermon on the Mount. But they don't do anything funny with Jesus. They just show Jesus, and then they pull way, way back to the far back of the crowd where people can't quite hear what he's saying, and they're kind of misinterpreting what he said, which is a good analogy. But in the movie, there are all these different political factions that are opposed to the Romans in general, because at the time, the Romans are occupying Judea and that whole area of the world. And the local people aren't really happy with them, even though the Romans did do a lot of things for them. There was a real funny sequence where in the meeting with one of the groups where they were talking about, what have the Romans done for us? Well, they have the aqueduct. Yeah, yeah, they're safing the streets and that. Yeah, yeah. And finally said, all right, but apart from this and this and this and this and this and this, what have the Romans done for us? Brought peace. Yes, peace. Shut up, you know. And that is one of several groups. The group that Brian wants to belong is called the People's Front of Judea. He wants to go to the Judean People's Front. And the only reason he wants to join the Judean People's Front is because there's this girl in there that he wants to, you know, get to know better. And there's also the People's Front of Judea, who I just mentioned, and the Popular Front of Judea, which turns out to be only one man. And they're all bickering with each other just as much as they bicker with the enemies. Just like in reality, the Sunnis and the Shiites and the Kurds would be bickering amongst each other if it hadn't been for Saddam Hussein holding them down with an iron fist and the fact that they're right now unified against the American occupation. And that's how they view it, as an occupation. But I was just thinking of the analogies between that and some of the bloggers, and some of the blog in the blogosphere going on. I'm not gonna mince any words here. I am not the biggest name on the blogosphere. Yeah, I know. My God, you're all shocked. I get maybe 50 hits a day. The hits have been up a little bit since my good friend Bart Kopp linked me on his site. He put it in his links area, which I'm grateful for because a lot of people watch Bart Kopp, and a lot of people have been linking. I've been getting more like 60 to 70 hits a day now, which isn't a lot, but hey, I'll take what I can get, you know. The really big guns out there right now, though, are Atrios and Daily Kos, mostly because they're using their websites as fundraising tools for the Democratic Party and doing a very good job of it, I might add. So they're getting all the big invites on Air America Radio. They're getting to go to all the events and stuff. And I don't necessarily have a problem with that. But there are a lot of bloggers, and myself included, I admit, we feel a little bit left out. I mean, just a simple mention by Atrios would mean a great deal to a small blogger like myself, it would generate hundreds of hits a day. Than the type of hits that a small blogger like myself would regularly never see, because I don't post several times a day like Atrios does or like the Daily Coast does. I post when I can, because like I said, I have to work for a living, and I don't work where I have access to a computer, as some people do. I think Atrios was is a consultant or a teacher or something like that, and obviously he has access to a computer during the course of a day. So, but even though I don't get that many hits, in my mind, that still doesn't diminish what I'm doing or make me want to stop doing it. Now, the Reverend Alan Brill of the Rite Christians, or the Village Gate as it's called now, same deal, now he felt like he was being ignored. He got into a little thing with Atrios because Atrios wrote this thing about how the religious left wasn't being politically active enough, and Reverend Brill fired back that they are. You're just under the radar and not as visible as you would like. You know, because the religious left is really not the same way as the religious right. They're not as fanatical. You know, they really believe in peace, love, forgiveness, and all the things that Jesus talked about. But, you know, unlike the right, they're not very well politically organized. Although they're getting there, and they are more politically organized than we realize. But Atrios had a big rant about it, and Reverend Bill fired back. And because of that, Reverend Bill felt like it was his presence on the blog, and he has many people who blog there, and it was his presence that was damaging the blog, getting less hits because Atrios said basically ignored him. Pardon me a second. A little drink there. Talking for 15 or 20 minutes like that tends to dry your throat out. At any rate, and he kind of like moved himself to the background. And he'll still post every now and then, but he doesn't really have as much say in what goes on or take as much interest in what goes on at the site as he did. And I think that's a bad thing. Because I think it was wrong for him to have minimized his presence. You know, he is that site. And it's just not as good a site since he's not active. And one of the reasons I'm bringing this up is the whole Laura Flanders thing. The whole Air America Radio thing. As I mentioned in a post on the blog, as I mentioned last week, I was invited to be on, as I mentioned earlier. And I thought the reasons I was given were pretty specious. But, you know, that's neither here nor there. Now, they contacted me because they saw the show on the White Rose Society. And, you know, the fact that they didn't have me on really did make me look like an idiot. Because I told my family, I told a few friends, you know, apart from just the regular bloggers who I know. When I was in the Bart Cop chat room around the time that I was supposed to be on, you know, they were like, are you on? And I said, no, they canceled me. And they were like, those sons of bitches, you know, and they were really, really angry and all that stuff. And I really don't know how to handle it. I mean, part of me is pretty upset that I didn't get left on. I mean, I don't get any money for doing my radio show, unlike any of the other people they have on the show. But, you know, it does mean a lot to me to have a little name recognition and to feel like I'm doing it for some reason. I mean, I'm not just masturbating here. I want to do something important. And I do want people to hear my message. But anyway, there's a part of me that says, just be patient. Be cool. They'll call you back, you know, and eventually. But there's another part of me that's screaming bloody murder about having an invitation withdrawn. And that means a lot to me. Now, if I want to be a success, I can't allow myself to be walked over like that. But I also am not in a position to make any demands. I mean, who gives a shit about a 50-hit-a-day blogger, right? I mean, I'm not the only one who feels this way, too. And it doesn't seem to have anything to do with the number of hits a site gets. Bart Cop, for example, gets hundreds of thousands of hits a day. And, you know, he hasn't, you know, Air America Radio isn't touching him. I think a lot of it for Atrios and Daily Coast is simply because they're doing the fundraising, and that's a very, very important thing. And Bart is really more like me. He's just like a working-class guy kind of spewing venom out into the airwaves to see what hits and what doesn't hit. And I'm just doing the best I can with the little talent that I have. And I listen to some of the other, you know, the regular talk show guys like the Mike Malloys and the Tom Hartmans and the Peter Werbys. And these guys are all smooth talkers. And people have complimented me on my voice. But I happen to know that I'm not the same kind of smooth talking guy that they are. And you know what? I really don't want to be. My voice is unique. My voice is the way it is. And I use my favorite example, Fran Drescher from The Nanny. She had a really, really nasty voice. That really high-pitched whine. Hi, how are you? And people told her for years that she would never make it in the industry with that voice, but she persevered and she became a success. I'm not saying I'm as talented as she is. I'm certainly not that talented. I'm not as funny. I'm not a... I don't even know if I'm going to be that hardworking, because when you put together a TV show, that takes a lot and a lot of work. You're talking about 12, 13, 14 hours a day. Of course, if it's what you love doing, then it doesn't really seem that way. But, you know, I know I don't have that kind of talent. I mean, but I do the best I can with what I have. And I do the show because I feel compelled to do it, as I've said from time and time again. So, really, for small bloggers like myself... The question is, do we have a right to demand a presence on Atrio's site simply because we're fighting the same fight? No, I don't think so. If Atrio's or if Daily Coast wants to link me, and actually I do have a link on Daily Coast. There was one guy who put together all the different bloggers who post on Daily Coast, and I get the occasional hit from that, and that's fine. But if they don't want to link to me, they don't have a reason to. I mean, it's their site, right? I'm just going to keep doing the show, and I'm going to keep blogging when I can. And given my limited abilities and lack of time, that may or may not be much, but I'm going to do everything I possibly can. And again, I think Reverend Vril was wrong for minimizing his presence on his site, because, like I said, he is the site. You know, and he can't be worried about what Atrios thinks or what Daily Coast thinks. You know, I don't want to say fuck them, and that's because that's really not my point. But they really can't worry too much about what kind of attention they're getting here and there. They have to keep doing what they're doing, because Atrios was in our position, you know, a couple of years ago when things were first starting out, and he managed to get hooked up. So maybe somebody will hook me up and say, hey, this guy's pretty cool, let's put him to work somewhere, or something along those lines. So for those of you who are worried about whether or not Joe's, you know, just whining and, you know, ranting and raving again, I'm not going to stop doing this. For the time being, I'm going to continue to do this for as long as I possibly fucking can, because I like doing this. I like having my own little radio show, and I love the internet for being able to allowing me to get my word heard somewhere. Even if I only have 100 or so listeners a show, or 50 or so listeners a show, or 50 a hit today on the blog, I really don't give a shit. Somebody out there is hearing it, and I think I have what I have to say is pretty decent and pretty cool and pretty important. And I'm going to continue to fighting. And the little infighting that goes on between the bloggers, like the Judean People's Front and the People's Front of Judea and the Popular Front, even if I'm the Popular Front, I'm the only guy sitting in the stadium or in my own area of the stadium, I'm not really worried about that. This is what I do, and this is what I'm going to do, and I'll let the other guys fight among themselves. And anybody who wants to, you know, co-link on my site, that's fine. I occasionally add them when I see someone's linked me. But, you know, I'm just going to keep doing. And if Atrios wants to drop by and say hi, send me a comment or something like that, that's fine. If he wants to link me, that's fine. But he's not obligated to, and I'm not asking him to. Anyway, let's take a quick little break. Sam, play us out.
We'll be right back with more of the Copper Joe Radio Show.
Back with the Cup of Joe Radio Show. I am your not-so-humble host, Joe Avecchio, the voice of the working man, the voice of the radical middle, and the voice of those who have been unvoiced by the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration and its corporate allies. Again, let me welcome everyone listening in at rantradio.com, at radiopower.org, and at cadronpictures.com. And, of course, not to forget my good friend Ben Birch from the White Rose Society, hosting my archives there. Thank you very much, Ben. I also want to remind everyone of the URL for the site. That's cupojoe.blogspot.com. And my email address is joevec@bellsouth.net. I urge people to write to me, to write messages in the comments in the blog. Send me something. Tell me how the show is going, all that stuff. And give me some material to help me out here. You know, I do this all by myself. I do everything all by myself. I'm just a poor, lonely man with a microphone. Well, I'm not that lonely. My wife is here with me. She's a laying down comfortably, trying hard to be quiet, and trying hard not to distract me while I'm here doing the show. I want to read you a couple of things here in this segment. There was an article by David Brooks in the New York Times, and I'm not going to read that article because I don't care much for Mr. Brooks. But it was interesting. The article basically dealt with the so-called civil war within the educated classes. It was in the New York Times, and there were a couple of letters to the editor that I wanted to bring out. And this one is from Frank McCourt in New York, and he writes, "To the editor, teachers across the country must have done a double take when they read David Brooks' June 15th column. He includes teachers in a large class of affluent knowledge workers. Where does he get his figures? Teachers up there with lawyers, architects, academics, and journalists? Who, by the way, are these academics, and how do they become affluent? Hands up all you teachers working summer jobs this year to sustain your affluence." Well put, Mr. McCourt. Teachers are among the lowest paid and most mistreated workers in the country. And no class of people is more important than teachers. Where else do all these academics come from if it wasn't for good teachers spurring them on, doing the things that need to be done? And they do it for such little pay and with such little support. But here's the one that I like. This is from Jeremiah O'Leary Jr., who's on Staten Island. And he writes, "To the editor, David Brooks worries too much about the civil war within the educated classes. Republican versus Democrat, manager versus professional, business class versus knowledge class. What I would like to know is, who represents the working class in this country? Somehow the so-called elites will survive despite all their differences. I'm more worried about those of us who are living paycheck to paycheck, struggling to send our kids to college and wondering if we'll be able to maintain our health care benefits. Who speaks for us?" Well, Mr. O'Leary, it may not mean much to you, and it probably doesn't mean much to a lot of people, but I speak for you, because I'm one of you. I understand exactly what you're going through. All these people up here at the top, all the assorted smartasses and high horses on the right and the left, respectively, they don't really give a shit about us. And I think we're discovering that. Maybe I'm discovering that with Air America Radio and their treatment of me. We'll see. We'll see. I'm not gonna say anything more just yet, and we'll see what happens over the course of the next couple of weeks. But you know, these high horse liberals who sit up there and well educated, very very rich compared to me anyway, who sit there and trying to change the world, the social engineer liberals as I call them, have completely forgotten about the working class that made the Democratic Party powerful. And this is why, of course, that I consider myself part of the radical middle. I do not fit in with these high horses, and I will never fit in with these high horses because they are too well educated for a lower class person like me, despite the fact that I'm relatively intelligent for your average working man. I do not fit in within their circles, and certainly you'll get no argument from me that the Republicans don't even give a shit about us. As far as we're concerned, as far as they're concerned, we're just here to help make them rich. And if we want to complain about it, then we have to either become like them or destroy them. And that really pisses me off because they really don't care about us very much. Nobody really cares about the working people in this country. But I do. And as long as I can continue to do it, I am going to speak out. And I realize it isn't a whole hell of a lot, but I'm going to do what I can to at least shed some light on these things. All the little things that go on in work. The little deaths that working people die every day and having more and more of their power stripped away while they seem helpless to do anything about it. And, of course, the even dumber ones who go out there and rather than wanting to change things for the better, just simply want us to all shut up and accept what we're given because, you know, the bosses are the bosses and we do what we tell them or that's it. So, Mr. O'Leary, there is someone who speaks out for you, and maybe one day the voice will be amplified. It may be just a cry in the wilderness right now, but it's out there. Certainly no politicians are doing it. I don't think Mr. Kerry cares very much for working people, or at least he doesn't care as much as he should. I don't understand. I saw all those union people supporting Rich Gephardt and whatever stuff that he might have done for them. I can't understand why they would think he would make a good president. It's all ambition and vanity and ego for a lot of these people. And I'm pretty much tired of it, to be perfectly honest. I'm pretty much tired of it. Anyway, there was I want to do this, changing gears here. This was something that I read on Hullabaloo, which is Digby's blog. Just Digby. That's all he is. He's a very good blog, actually. And I'm going to do something that I don't generally do. I'm going to read the entirety of this article that he wrote. And it's dealing with the whole torture situation. And I thought he put the best line to it that anybody could. And let me just go over the article. It started out where he was talking about his early days of blogging. So let me just go ahead and read it verbatim. He writes, back in the early blog days, I used to read Instapundit regularly. Instapundit is a right-wing blogger, for those of you who don't know. Compared to the Neanderthal wing nuts I commonly sparred with on bulletin boards and the like, he was a breath of fresh air. But after 9/11, like so many, he stopped making sense on a regular basis, and I ended up having to put him in the life is too short file. Since then, when I do check in over there or follow a link, I am quite stunned at how knee-jerk he has become, even while there are nuggets of good sense still sometimes tucked between the lines. Another blogger, Iglesias, reminds me today of both why I used to like him and why he is so insufferable today. And the Instapundit writes, I find it hard to respond to these things in terms of cost-benefit. My law school mentor, Charles Black, once said that of course you can come up with scenarios, the classic ticking nuclear bomb example, where torture might be justified. And you can be sure that, in those cases, if people think it'll work, they'll use it to no matter what the rules are. But there's a real value to pretending that there's an absolute rule against it, even if we know people will break it in extraordinary circumstances, because it ensures that people won't mistake an ordinary remedy for an extraordinary one. And Iglesias responded, well said. But then Instapundit continues, I also think that the rather transparent effort to use this against Bush, often by people who think nothing of cozying up to the likes of Castro, for whom torture and murder are essential tools of governance, has caused the Abu Ghraib issue to be taken less seriously than perhaps it ought to be. Now Digby continues, taking the second part first, when exactly did Reynolds, who is the writer for Instapundit, decide that he had to ask Kiss the Right with such sycophantic upside-downism? It's the left's fault, because if they didn't make such a big deal out of it and hold Bush accountable, people would take the issue more seriously? What Galepsius nonsense. It's that kind of hackery that makes Reynolds unreadable. The first part of his analysis, as Iglesias points out with his well said, is quite interesting and relevant, however. It's one that people don't talk about much, perhaps because to debate it openly would render the concept useless. It's a bit cynical and even a bit dishonest, but Iglesias can see the utility of it, and so can I, Dershowitz's tortured theories notwithstanding. The idea that the ticking time bomb scenario might call for someone to break the law and face the consequences of doing so gets to the nub of our concerns with torture and the right of self-defense. As Reynolds points out, people will likely employ torture in a real ticking bomb scenario, whether it is legal or not. It's ridiculous to think someone wouldn't if the scenario were as straightforward as it's always presented. But by outlawing acts of torture in all circumstances, you prevent using torture in interrogations that are not ticking time bomb scenarios, because you force the person who breaks that prohibition to show that it was a matter of self-defense. The bar is high. It must be so obvious that prosecutors or a jury of your peers can see that your actions directly saved the lives of specific would-be victims. It would be a transparent legal process that everyone can judge based on the specific facts of the case. Finding that someone acted in self-defense under these circumstances would no more nullify our prohibition against torture than finding a policeman who acted in self-defense by shooting an armed man threatening people at a bus stop. The individual circumstances reviewed in an open legal process are all that would ever be required to justify the ticking time bomb torture defense. And since there are an infinitesimal number of ticking time bomb cases, this specific circumstance is interesting but largely theoretical, and therefore it's actually a red herring. The real problem we face here is determining what does and what does not constitute a ticking time bomb, and what does and does not constitute self-defense. And that is where the Bush administration has gone so far off the rails as to be flying. It's not just that the torture memos explicitly give the president unprecedented powers to set aside the laws of the land, something that the libertarian Reynolds should at least get a little bit excited exercised about, but that after 9/11, the Bush administration decided that the definition of self-defense is unlimited, even including preventative war. Under their definition, pretty much anything goes. Somebody looks at you sideways, kill him. Why take a chance he might have a gun and shoot you first? Somebody says somebody might have some useful information, torture him. It could save lives. In that sense, all threats, real or imagined, immediate or potential, are considered ticking time bombs that we have a right and obligation to defuse any way we can. This definition of self-defense is what makes it possible to excuse wanton torture, unprovoked aggression, lying and manipulation, and usurpation of democracy itself. And what makes it so dangerous is that it allows it to be done under the umbrella of patriotism and the rule of law. Now, I have no doubt many Americans see any act that might prevent further attacks as justified. Perhaps there are even quite a few who believe that if many thousands of innocent people, including children, are swept up in this preventive activity, it is a sad but necessary and moral thing. But in order for this to make sense at any point, one would have to assume that the government has some idea of what the threat is in the first place and knows who can tell them what they need to know to prevent it. Unfortunately, recent events have just proven on the grandest scale imaginable that our government wouldn't know a ticking time bomb if it fell into the Oval Office with a goddamn sign on it. The Bush administration did, after all, just invade a country on the basis of a threat that simply didn't exist after ignoring people running around with their hair on fire for months about a threat that actually did. I'm afraid I just don't have a lot of faith in these fellows' ability to know when we are and aren't being threatened. So perhaps it's best not to leave the definition of what constitutes self-defense in the hands of such incompetence and rely instead on the long-established legal definitions that stood us in good stead through 223 years. Human beings, as it turns out, aren't very good at playing God. The extreme overreaction of the government to the attacks of 9/11, heinous as they were, and its subsequent willingness to dispose of all previously agreed upon limitations to its ability to act in self-defense, led directly to pictures of torture being shown all over the world, pictures symbolizing American indecency, immorality, incompetence, and relentless will to power. And there is a paper trail that leads directly to the Oval Office, where the man who sits behind the desk there says he never ordered anything illegal, and the world should be comforted by that. If not that man, then who should we hold responsible for the other vacuousness that has replaced a previously complex system of belief in the rule of law and inalienable human rights with a lizard-brained definition of self-defense they wrap up in meaningless terms like moral clarity? The only people I see imitating Castro these days are sitting in the White House. And that's the end of that. That is an absolutely awesome piece of work by Mr. Digby. And he is absolutely friggin' right. Imagine if say, you were in a high school and there was no teachers or the authorities figures there were as incompetent a group as what's running the government right now. Among the students, or among the different gangs and factions of the students, any sign of dissing would lead to immediate violence. Is that the kind of world you want to live in? And that's what it's all about. Man, you're disrespecting me, take them out. You got to keep them separated, as the song says. And that's what we've come down to. It's just monumental acts of dissing and retaliation that never ends. You don't have to believe me. Ask the Israelis and the Palestinians. It's a never-ending bloodshed. That's why you have to set the bar so high. And that's why you have to go back on the rule of law and not rule of men. Because as we've seen, men are corrupt, men are vain, men can be evil. Even men who claim to be of God can be all of these things. So don't throw the religious argument at me. The rule of law is very plain and clear. We make the laws and we elect our representatives to enforce the laws and to change the laws if they need changing. And if they don't do their jobs, we vote them out of office. Mr. Bush, Mr. Rumsfeld, Mr. Wolfowitz, all the people who are behind this whole thing, they're war criminals as far as I'm concerned. We not only have to kick them out of office, we need to put them on trial. We need to impeach them. We need to put them on trial. We need to turn them over to the World Court for prosecution. Only in this way can we show to the world that we are serious about democracy. If Mr. Bush gets another 4 years, it's a rubber stamp for them. And it means to the rest of the world that we approve of this. This is who we are. This is what we want. And then it's really us against the world. Now, if that's what we want as a country, then we better be prepared for the consequences of it, because they will be dire. They will be severe. The world is like a neighborhood. And when one neighbor starts acting too obnoxious, guess what? The other neighbors will rise up and take their own action. What we need in this world is a global police force or a global military that is stronger than the military of any single nation. One that's run by rule of law and one that can prevent such atrocities. Will such corruption come if we have such corruption as we have now? Will that come if we have that sort of thing in the future? Yes, I'm sure it will. But those are problems for future generations to solve. It is not our problem to deal with those situations. It is our problem to deal with the situation that we have now. And the situation that we have now is the most powerful nation on earth militarily acting as a rogue nation. And you can sit there and scream about a freedom fries and all that shit, but you're all full of shit. You're all full of shit. Mr. Reynolds, Mr. Lewis, all the other people who sit there talking about morals, have no moral right to do so, because you are the most immoral group of people I've ever seen. You're justifying this wanton torture and saying that anybody who's against it is just as bad as the terrorists, where the truth of the matter is that you're just as bad as the terrorists. You want to use the same methods. You want to subvert the law just as much as they do. Nobody can justify these tortures, the things that we did, except the unbelievably insane or the incredibly naive. It is wrong. It is just plain fucking wrong. And I don't know how to make it any clearer than that. It's incredible how the people who lash out against moral relativism all of a sudden get morally relative when it comes to stuff that helps them out. There is no relativism here. Torture is wrong. And under the circumstances that Mr. Digby said, the only time you can even imagine it is if the threat was so clear and present that no one could deny it. That's why we have courts. That's why we examine these things to make sure. And that's why we set the standard so high, so that people don't abuse. And that's what we're doing now. We're abusing it. Iraq has been a thorn in our side for years. We can't have that. And, you know, I was reading another article where they're talking about the military bases that they're building in Iraq. And, of course, the neocons' plan, it's on all on the Project for a New American Century's website, is to use Iraq for a launching point for wars against Iran, Syria, Jordan, an effort to take over the entire Middle East. And from what I'm hearing in Saudi Arabia, things are starting to go to hell there. You know, the royal family is not particularly well-liked by their own people, who are much more fundamentalist than we hear about. And don't forget, of the 19 hijackers of those planes, 17 of them came from Saudi Arabia. Two of them came from Egypt. None of them were from Afghanistan, although I agreed with the campaign against Afghanistan at the beginning. Of course, I knew that these people wouldn't be the one that carried it out. And, of course, none of them were from Iraq, nor did anyone have anything to do with, nor did Iraq have anything to do with what happened on 9/11. This has been shown conclusively. Not that the vice president would know, because he's still spouting the same old bullshit. It's just fucking wrong. It's just fucking wrong. Sam, play us out.
The Copper Joe Radio Show will be right back.
Cover Joe Radio Show. I am your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio, the voice of the working man, the voice of the radical middle, and the voice of those who have been unvoiced by the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration and its corporate allies. And again, welcome everyone listening at rantradio.com, radiopower.org, cadrenpictures.com, and of course, thank you to my good friend Ben Birch at the White Rose Society, whiterosesociety.org, for hosting my archives there. And once again, the URL for the site is cupojoe.blogspot.com, and my email address is joevec@bellsouth.net. Now, despite all the other stuff going on, with all the Iraq stuff, you know what Americans think is important. And, of course, at Y Work, it was basketball. It was the NBA Finals. And I did not like the Lakers at all, and I am very, very happy that they got their ass kicked. I generally don't talk about sports on the show much, even though I'm a big sports fan, and I'm one of those people who can discuss with relative intelligence pretty much any subject, whether you're talking Thucydides or you're talking NBA basketball or anime or politics, whatever. You know, I delve a little bit into everything, just enough knowledge to make me dangerous, right? But I hate the Lakers because I feel like the NBA gives them such a push to get up there. I mean, how many really, really bad calls have gone the Lakers' way in the last 5 or 6 years or so to help them get them through the playoffs and into the finals through some tough competition? There was the famous game against Sacramento that Sacramento should have won and therefore won the series that just basically got stolen from them by the referees. And the game in Minnesota, where the Lakers were up, the Timberwolves were up by like 5 points with like 4 seconds left or something like that. And they gave Kobe Bryant a 4-point play on a shot that he was not even touched. A guy was just basically running past him with his hair and hand in the air. Didn't come within the, close enough for them to even consider a foul, but they called a little ticky-tack foul on him. And, you know, the Lakers would have wound up winning that game if Kobe had just made one more free throw. That wound up going into overtime. Even though Minnesota won, it was just an example of the lengths the NBA will go through. The reason why the Lakers lost last year in the playoffs to San Antonio is because San Antonio kicked their ass. That's the only way you can beat the Lakers. That is the absolute only way you can beat the Lakers in the NBA playoffs, getting to the finals anyway, is to kick their ass all over the court. Don't give them a chance. Because if it's a close game, the referees are under order, as far as I'm concerned, to make sure that the Lakers win. Right foul here, right foul there. You know, basketball is a game you can fix. And as far as I'm concerned, the game has been fixed for years, as far as that thing is concerned. They always give way too much to their big stars because, you know, David Stern, the NBA commissioner, understands that it's all about entertainment. The integrity of the game be damned. And it's all about entertainment. But along comes the Detroit Pistons, who do not have a qualified superstar in the team. They've got some good players. Ben Wallace, Rasheed Wallace, Chauncey Billups, the guy who won. I believe he won the MVP of the series. But the thing about it is, and that, to me, I think it's a good analogy for just liberalism in general. The thing about it is that Detroit was just a bunch of, considered to be a bunch of like a working class guys who worked together as a team rather than just the bunch of overblown superstars that constantly bickered amongst each other on the Lakers. And the Lakers brought in Karl Malone and Gary Payton, and everyone was saying, well, they're just due in for another shot at, you know, another title. And they would have gotten away with it if it wasn't for them meddling kids in Detroit. And what happened was actually there was a key game against San Antonio, and this was the turning point for me. And this was my NBA rig moment of the series when the guy launched that shot with 0.4 seconds left on the clock, and they counted it. And that meant, you know, and that won the game for the Lakers against San Antonio and made the series 3-1 instead of 2-2. And to me, that was the nail in the coffin for the Spurs. And that pretty much showed, again, the NBA's bias toward the Lakers, even though they kind of deserted them in the finals. You know, the NBA, really, I don't think they give a shit if the Lakers win it so much as they just get there. I think the only thing that the NBA was pissed off at is that the series only lasted 5 games. But the fact of the matter is, Detroit's defense, their team defense, stifled all the big superstars. None of them can get anything done because they didn't work as a team. I remember the Chicago Bulls championship teams, and Chicago has won like 7 championships, since Michael Jordan's rise. But even Chicago had trouble getting past Detroit their first couple of times, and Detroit won one of those appearances against the Lakers way back in 1981, I think it was. But it was after that the Bulls took off, and they took off because they played like a team. They had superstars, but they played like a team. And that, to me, is an analogy of life itself. There is no I in team, and the Republicans always insist that I is everything. Libertarians always insist that I is everything, and it's bullshit. It's not everything. There is I, and there is individual glory, yes, there is, but when you really want to accomplish something, you have to work as a team. And that's what I talk about when I talk about liberalism, when I talk about people working together for their own benefit. You know, a good team, you know, the Pistons, they listened to the coach told them what to do, but it wasn't all about the coach. It was about the coach just doing the right things to make sure everybody worked together as a team. And Larry Brown, this was his first NBA championship in many, many, many years as coach. And he's been a very good coach. He's gone around to a lot of different teams, and he's always done very well. This is his only NBA championship, however. And he is actually now the only coach who have won an NCAA title and an NBA championship. But when people work together, things get done more. And when people are focused more towards a goal. Now, I realize for the Lakers, losing is a bit of personal humiliation, but you know what? They all get to go to their million-dollar mansions and stuff like that. And the reason why they all get to go home to their million-dollar mansions is because as the union players, as a union of basketball players, they work together as a team. If you destroy the unions, as the Major League Baseball is trying to destroy the baseball players' union, then you'll see things go down. People bitch about the big salaries, and I've said this before in the show, and I'll say it again. People bitch about the big salaries that these stars make, but you know what? It's so few people, and for the most part, they so fucking deserve it because they can do things more so in baseball, I think, because the art of hitting a baseball is so difficult. So difficult, and to play it at that level and to play it constantly. And most people's careers in any professional sport don't last more than 3 or 4 years. And it's so hard to get up to that point, too. Maybe it's a little easier in basketball and football because, you know, they have college is a big deal there, and you get a lot more exposure and a lot better chance. Baseball doesn't have that luxury. Hockey doesn't have that luxury. And hockey is in problems now because they have to re-sign their contract, and their future is very much in doubt right now. If they have a lockout or a walkout, that can be very, very damaging to them. They just signed a big contract with NBC for television rights for nothing. Basically said, here, televise our games. You don't have to give us anything. And they're just hoping that the publicity will help them out. I actually like hockey as a sport, but, man, the fighting gets to be too much. They had that one guy last year that basically knocked out. And it's pretty, you know, I've been watching hockey for years, and that sort of stuff is kind of commonplace, but it's just gotten a little more intense over the last few years. People getting really seriously hurt and stuff like that. So, but congratulations to the Detroit Pistons. I am so happy that you kicked the Lakers' ass. You have no idea, because I get so sick of hearing it from people who are Lakers. You know, people who are Lakers fans and people who are Yankees fans in baseball, they just like the teams because they win. They're not real sports fans. Real sports fans are Cubs fans and Red Sox fans and guys who go watch the Memphis Grizzlies or the Orlando Magic. Those are real sports fans because their teams suck, but they go there and root for them anyway. You know, the old Brooklyn Dodgers used to be really, really bad. before they got to be a good team. They used to be really, really bad. And the fans in the stands, that rhymed. And the fans there were some of the most well-known things about the team than anything else. I remember seeing documentaries about it and my dad telling me about it because he used to go to Ebbets Field. And it's a different atmosphere, even though they knew the team was bad. And then when they got good, it was a different thing, too. And sometimes when you get good, attendance goes down. You know, the Yankees struggled for attendance during the time they won the most championships. And the Dodgers started to have trouble with attendance when they played good after a while. And just like the Braves here in Atlanta, who have been a very good team, haven't been able to win many World Series. They've only won one since 1991, although they've won 12 straight divisions. They've been a very, very good, very consistent team, over 500 for like 13 years, which is fantastic. And even though they probably won't win the division, they've got enough talent on the team to at least stay around the 500 mark, so they might finish over 500 this year. I think it was the Baltimore Orioles from the 1960 to like 1980 who finished over 500 like 17 out of those years. Even though they only had a couple of World Series out of that, it's just an incredible achievement. And it shows what happens when you have a good organization and everybody works well as a team. In baseball, you can have that a little bit more because you have the farm system and you can bring people up and, you know, train them in a certain way that you like them to play. Some teams have certain styles. For example, the Dodgers are known for their pitching and for their defense. The Yankees are known for their hitting. So are the Reds known for their hitting. So, you know, it's all a question of what kind of style of team that you want to have and perfecting that. But with all of that, all the libertarian talk about it's all I this and I that, and all the Republican talk about, oh, you know, the special people, and the motor of the world, as the Randians call it, it's all a bunch of bullshit. It's all a bunch of bullshit. You know, in Atlas Shrugged, the whole premise was all these people who are the motor of the world, the ones that make everything work, they just up and quit and the whole world goes to hell. And I say, that's a bunch of horseshit. You want to see the whole world go to hell, let everybody stop working. Then you'll see the whole world go to hell. Let's have a general strike for 1 month, everybody not do a damn thing. Then we'll see what happens. Not fix the roads, not run the traffic lights, not be there at the cash registers. You'll see what happens. Because I'll tell you something. You know, what we ought to do? We ought to have general strikes in certain areas. Everybody just go on strike for a month in areas where the rich and affluent live. They can't get none of their services. Can you see some guy on the phone demanding something and the guy in the back just laughing at him? On the other end of the phone just laughing at him? Or maybe not even getting an answer at all. Can't do anything. Can't get gas because no gas stations are open. Can't go out and get something to eat because the supermarkets are all shut down. You want to be a fucking libertarian, go out and grow your own fucking food, asshole. And no matter how good you are, no matter how big superstars you are, even if you have four future Hall of Famers on your team, you can't always win just having that talent. As I said, there is no I in team. In American democracy, we are a team. And we work together. And we don't put ourselves above the law. And we all chip in with taxes and with our labor and with our presence at meetings or you know, political activism in all its forms. The Democrats need to learn this lesson a little bit more. We've devolved into all these little fractions, and we need to just say, listen, let's get together under one umbrella and we can handle all of these issues. You know, in politics, everybody doesn't get everything that they want. How did that Rolling Stones song go? You can't always get what you want, but if you try sometimes, you get what you need. And if we would understand that very, very simple philosophy, we would do a lot better for ourselves. Anyway, I see by the clock on the wall that it's just about time to wrap this thing up. I want to thank again all my listeners at rantradio.com. At radiopower.org. I want to thank Ben Birch for hosting my archives at the White Rose Society. And for all the crew here, all one of us, at the Cup of Joe Radio Show, I just wanted to say so long, see ya, and we'll be here on Sunday. Everybody take care, have a good couple of days off, and hopefully you'll listen in on Saturday at Audio Hell at Cam Mafia Radio. More info on that next show. Anyway, bye-bye. Joe Vecchio, the host of the Cup of Joe radio show, is proud to be a member of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local 2127. However, the views of Joe Vecchio do not necessarily represent the views of Local 2127, the IBEW, or its affiliate, the AFL-CIO. Please remember to support your working brothers and sisters and help keep the American dream alive. The Cup of Joe radio show has been a production of Jove Enterprises Incorporated.